Unlock big savings and add style and security to your home with high-quality Schlage door locks from Menards. Whether you're looking for a traditional interior lock or a Wi-Fi-compatible electronic lock, Menards has you covered. With more than 200 options of Schlage door locks in stock, save big on all door locks. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. Oh, actually, just before we start, apparently Zoom has now done it so that you can only, for it's not just for like more than two people that it cuts off at 40 minutes, it's everybody. So it will cut off at 40 minutes.
Okay.
So I will, like, as it approaches that time, I'll just be like, oh, it's nearly there. And then we'll come off and come back on. I'm going to look into a different video provider, but it's just something that's on my list of things to do. Just that annoyance as well. But yeah. Okay, cool. Today I'm joined by Melinda Carth. Melinda is a PhD candidate in neuroscience at Purdue, where she researches eating disorders. Melinda's PhD is titled The Effects of Anorexia Symptoms in Adolescence on Anxiety in Adulthood After Weight Gain. And she joins us today to discuss eating disorders, neuroscience, and animal models. Hello, Melinda.
Hi, Hannah.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm fine, apart from this really annoying drilling that I hope is not going to be too, like, literally as I clicked onto this call with you started. So great timing, but now I can't run out and be like, oh, can you stop? But other than that, the sun is shining and it's nearly the weekend, so that's good. So thank you so much for joining me to chat today. I'm super excited to speak to you about animal models and neuroscience and everything, because it's like an amazing part of research that we haven't spoken about yet. So I guess to start with, would you mind explaining to the listeners kind of how you got into neuroscience?
I didn't start in neuroscience. My first, foray into eating disorders was my experiences with figure skating. Mm-hmm. So what's interesting about my experience is that I started when I was around 12, and most people start skating when they're 3 or 4. Mm-hmm. So already I was feeling self-conscious about my body and older than everyone else. And one of the biggest problems with skating is that they really reward you being younger and thinner. And we see this all the time with like competitions. People are getting younger and younger, and there are a lot of eating disorders within the sport. People often retire when they're like barely 15 years old or 16 years old and they have eating disorders. So for me, that's basically when I started excessively exercising and restricting my food intake. I mean, obviously, there were other factors that contributed to my eating disorder, but for me, that kind of really triggered it. And so I became really strict with my diet and I exercised a lot. And I kind of grew up with this idea that being thin was more rewarding than, I guess, allowing your body to mature. So then what happened was, I eventually stopped skating, and, when I stopped skating, I remember thinking, you know, that I didn't really have a reason to eat anymore because, I wasn't an athlete. And for some reason it didn't really occur to me that that would be an eating disorder, but, to deal with that, the fact that I wasn't skating anymore, I really increased my exercising behavior and I still restricted my food intake. So that was kind of an ongoing thing for me for a long time. And ironically, what I went into after I stopped skating was I wanted to do culinary arts. So I was making things like desserts and everything. And eventually I realized that when you're doing culinary school, they require you to taste things. So I was really uncomfortable with that. And after about 6 months, I just couldn't handle it. So I dropped out. And then I went to university to study media. And while I was studying media, I thought, okay, as long as I'm in university, I might as well be doing a degree that I think is fun too. And I've always found psychology and like human behavior in different disorders, especially because of my own experiences, interesting. So I was kind of getting, for fun, a degree in psychology. And I wasn't really planning on doing anything with it. So then after I graduated, I got a master's in media from the University of Leeds. And it was about that time when I started to get really frustrated because while I think media and media influence on eating disorders is, you know, really important, and it definitely does play a role in the development of eating disorders, it was frustrating for me because everyone's exposed to the same media, like everyone's exposed to the same diet ads, you know, the same body image messages, but not everyone develops an eating disorder. So I wanted to look more at, you know, it on an individual level and kind of understand eating disorder development more from like a neuroscience perspective. So I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do at that point. I came back to the US and around that time, my dad died from a heart attack. And that was like completely out of the blue. And it was a really shocking experience for me. And then it was probably because of that, but also because just like my whole life had been, you know, just kind of thrown up into the air and I didn't know what I was going to do. I just said, you know, okay, if you could study anything, like, what do you want to do now? And so I decided to get a master's in psychology looking at specifically neuroscience. And so I joined a lab with no experience. I'd never worked with animals before. I'd never worked in a research lab before. And I started working with transgenic mice and looking at binge eating in relation to serotonin and treatments for that. And then now I'm at Purdue doing a neuroscience PhD, looking at more anorexia behavior.
Wow. I love that journey because especially sort of, I think, you know, I don't know whether it's the same in the US, but in the UK, you're kind of made to make a decision at 18 as to what do you want to do when you go to uni and what's your career path going to be? And who knows at 18, like, even if you've got a very clear career pathway, you know, who knows what you want to be. So I really like the fact that what you actually did was kind of picked out the things that you liked from them, from media, and thought, I do like the human behavior and maybe that's something to go down. So that's definitely quite an inspiring route that you took. I also love the fact that you went into a lab with like no experience as well, because so many people would think, oh, neuroscience, like if I'm going to do that, I've got to have so much experience in psychology and the brain and stuff. And actually we all start somewhere. So yeah, if anybody is interested in that sort of thing, then I think that's really inspiring. But I wanted to ask you more about the animal models, because that, I mean, that sounds so cool. So let's start with the binge eating disorder animal model. So kind of, you mentioned serotonin, but what was the aim and sort of what were you trying to work out there?
So the binge eating rodent model that we use for in rodents, basically how it works is you do 2 days of regular food and it's also mixed with like a high fat food. And then what you do is you give them 24 or 5 days of the regular food, and then you give them 24 hours of the yummy food, and then 6 days of the regular food. And if you do this over the course of like 6 weeks, what happens is the rodents start to eat, like binge on the high fat food or like the yummy food. So they're eating more and more calories each time. So they're creating like, creating like a binge like eating behavior. But what's really interesting about this model that I forgot was that despite eating more calories, these animals don't develop significant increases in weight or in fat. So I think that's really interesting because there's this stigma that binge eating is associated with a certain weight. When these animals are binge eating over the course of like a month and a half or 2 months, and they're not gaining weight and they're not gaining fat. So I think that's really interesting.
Do you have any conclusions as to why that was?
No, I don't. But there's actually still not a lot that we know about some of these animal models. Like, we're just kind of like testing things out and then seeing how they work. As for why that one works, one idea is that it might be serotonin related. So serotonin is involved in a lot of different things, but one of the things that it's really involved in is telling you when you're full. So the mice that I was using, they had deficiency in serotonin. So they were genetically modified to have low levels of serotonin in their brain. And so what that would potentially mean is that they would be more hungry more often. One idea is that binge eating, one thing that might cause binge eating is changes in serotonin. But that might be one reason why that model works, something about changes in the serotonin levels over time.
Okay. Am I correct in thinking that serotonin is also the happy hormone?
Yeah, so serotonin is involved in a lot of things. In fact, that's why a lot of different disorders are given serotonin type drugs, is because it's involved in so many different things. A lot of the times, medical professionals will prescribe serotonin, type pharmaceuticals, because it's involved in so many different things, it's worth trying. You know, maybe serotonin's involved in, depression, maybe it's involved in eating behavior, and oftentimes it'll help alleviate some of those symptoms for a bunch of different disorders.
Wow. That's really cool that it's very interesting that it's linked to happiness and then fullness as well. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there's quite a few different molecules that kind of have a lot of different responsibilities.
Yes.
So I guess the question then is, so I mean, I'm guessing that with animal models, something like binge eating disorder, it's multifactorial, there's so many things, so that's kind of like a part of the puzzle. So if you were showing what you showed with that study, how does that then translate to humans?
So for that study, I was looking at a drug to treat binge eating disorder. So we looked at fluoxetine, which is a serotonin reuptake inhibitor, so an SSRI. Mm-hmm. And basically the way that works is, this is a simple answer, but it increases serotonin in your brain. So we wanted to see if the mice that had low levels of serotonin in their brains, if this drug would work for them in decreasing binge eating disorder as well, because one of the things that's prescribed to people who have binge eating disorder are often these serotonin drugs. And so often when we're testing new drugs, we first test them in animals, obviously because it's safer, we can control more of like the factors involved in the study. So basically that's what that's good for, is it's like a preclinical test. We test the drug, or we test different things in animals first. And then what we do is we can then, if we find something like, oh, wow, this really works, then we can then move it into studying in humans.
Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. I think that's probably a sensible thing. In terms of participant recruitment and stuff, it's probably easier to get your hands on some mice rather than participants. But I was also just thinking, and I mean, I guess this probably wouldn't be something, I mean, I don't know, you can tell me, but I was just thinking, as you were talking about the serotonin there, in terms of, if the serotonin, wait, am I getting my head around this properly? I think I'm getting muddled up. So the drug, does that mean that somebody has more serotonin when they have the SSRI or less serotonin?
So what the SSRI does is it's supposed to increase serotonin in your brain. So the idea is that if people with binge eating disorder, or just people in general who have binge eating disorder who might have low levels of serotonin, checking to see if this drug would still work for them. So it's kind of looking more at like individualized treatment.
Sure. Again, that was the path my brain was going down. So, when you just suddenly freeze and you think, actually, have I got this completely the wrong way around? But basically what my head was thinking was, for a lot of people with binge eating disorder, binging can often be quite an emotional response.
Yes.
So, feeling sad, feeling lonely, kind of using the binging as a numbing. So could it also be that the serotonin, the SSRIs help to improve mood, which then causes less binging?
Yes, most definitely. And yeah, that's really important to mention, because I think there's a stigma that binge eating is just people who might have like, I guess, dysfunction in like hunger signals, you know, oh, it's just about they're always hungry. But that's, you know, hasn't really found to be the case. Mm-hmm. There's also like this emotional component and a whole bunch of other different factors. It's not just because they're really hungry. Mm-hmm. So the emotional part is really important to mention too.
Sure. Amazing. Well, there you go. You learn something new every day. That's really cool. I really like, yeah, I think that's really, really interesting. And then I think you mentioned when we were talking before as well that you've done some animal models with anorexia. Is that correct?
Yes. So there's actually anorexia. One of the reasons that there's a lot of studies with anorexia, at least in animals, is because some of the most, we have some of the most animal models for looking at anorexia. So like for binge eating disorder, we really only have that one model. And for other eating disorders, we don't really have animal models yet to look at things. But with anorexia, we have a few different models that we can use. And the one that we use in the lab that I'm in is called activity-based anorexia. And basically how that works is you first fast the animals for 24 hours, and then you give them limited access to regular food and continuous access, so 24 hours access to a running wheel. And basically what ends up happening is the rats will start running more and eating less. So even though the food is presented to them, they'll ignore the food and they'll start running more and more on their wheels. Mm-hmm. And you have to be really careful because they could run themselves, they could starve themselves to death. So we're only allowed to do it for like a few days at a time because we have to, you know, obviously make sure that the animals are well taken care of. But what's interesting is that if you give rats 24 hours access to food and also continuous access to a running wheel, you don't see the same effects. So.
Wow. Okay. It's interesting how similar that is to humans. I mean, yes. I'm just basically thinking about my personal experience here, but at the start of my eating disorder, I did feel like I could just exercise continuously and not need the food. So is there sort of like a brain component going on there that has been documented that's similar between the mice and humans?
Yes. So what's interesting is that we know that hyperactivity is one of the first symptoms to develop in humans with anorexia. So it's interesting that that develops so quickly in the rats. Mm-hmm. And we're not really sure why this model works. But one reason we think that it might work is that something happens in the brain that kind of flips it. So that way, exercise is more rewarding than eating, which is, you know, something that I think people with anorexia experience is that I know for myself personally, the exercise became more rewarding than the eating. So something might happen at that point, at some point where your brain says, okay, exercise is more rewarding than eating now.
It's really interesting. I'm just thinking about like that maintenance, because mm-hmm. I know and obviously this is just anecdotal again, but for me, like the reason that I maintained that exercise, I mean, I guess this probably wasn't the whole thing, but was the comments from other people, like commenting on how well I looked from losing weight and stuff. So it's really interesting that the mice actually maintain that behavior despite they don't have that like social interaction.
Yeah, and that's one of the benefits of animal models is that while we're missing like the psychological component and, you know, all those social factors, we can really look at the behavior. And it's interesting to just see that behavior develop, even though we don't have all of those other factors. And that kind of, you know, really drives home the fact that these are biological illnesses. You know, these are serious, legitimate illnesses. It's not just somebody doing something because they want to, you know, look a certain way.
Absolutely. Is there anything else that kind of in the research that has been shown from these transgenic mice models about eating disorders?
So there's a transgenic mouse model of anorexia. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting with these mice is that they self-starve, and this is kind of sad, but they self-starve, and so they don't live very long. But this is a way that we can kind of see you know, the genetics behind self-starvation. And so for those mice, I think it might be some kind of genetic mutation in areas involved with like motivation to eat. But again, with those mice, they only live like a very short lifespan because they starve. So we can't do like long-term studies with them.
So there is literally a part in the brain that controls your motivation to eat, and you can kind of manipulate that.
Well, you mean like researchers can manipulate that? Oh, yes. And there's a really cool technique you can use. I don't use it. I think it's very expensive, but it's called optogenetics. And basically what you can do is you can manipulate different cells in the brain with light. So you can turn off different cells and like turn them on sort of like a video game. And then you can see like subsequent behavior from turning off those cells and turning them on. So like you can make animals, you know, binge eat, you know, you can make them not eat, you know, so things like that.
That's insane. That's crazy. And they kind of map from humans to mice those areas, or are they the different areas in the brain?
They're pretty similar. So mice are about 98% genetically similar to humans, and rats are about 92% genetically similar. And there are some differences, like especially with like the size of different brain regions. But for the most part, especially with rats, the rat brain is structured very similarly to the human brain.
That is so cool. That's amazing. And you mentioned earlier kind of there was a model for binge eating and for anorexia, but I'm guessing from the way that you said it, there isn't really a model for bulimia or?
No. Yeah, for bulimia, basically what researchers are using is the binge eating model, but we know that that is not bulimia. So that's why you don't really see a lot of animal research with other eating disorders, is because we haven't developed models yet to look at things like.
So is it sort of the purging behaviors that are kind of the unknown in terms of the animal model?
Yeah, and mice and rats do not have the ability to throw up. They actually can't. So that's one purging behavior that we can't use in an animal model.
Right. Okay. But I guess, I mean, would that be ethical to give them laxatives? Would there be something you could do with that, or because you're giving it to them, I suppose you're giving them the high pellet food, so?
So with animal studies, there are really strict protocols that we have to follow. We have to like submit things and have them approved, and we have to justify why we're doing the research. So yeah, there are, you probably could do things like that. You just would need to justify, you know, why you were doing it, and to demonstrate, you know, how you're going to take care of the animals and things like that.
Just as you were saying that, it's come to my mind about one of the blogs that you wrote about giraffes and I genuinely can't remember the blog, but I remember reading it and thinking that is actually amazing. Do you mind just explaining to the listeners what that was about?
So we know that pica is the craving and eating of things that aren't considered edible. When we're looking at it in animals, it's usually geophagia. So that is eating things like sand, dirt, and clay, or osteophagia. So that's eating bones. And one of the animals that engages in this a lot are giraffes. If you just search on the internet, giraffes and pica, you will see like a ton of different articles and videos of giraffes eating bones and stuff. And the reason that they do this is like mineral deficiencies, like their environment is barren and they need to find minerals in, you know, in some way. But what's interesting is that I saw an article from just that was published just last month. And so what they did was they looked at a Bengal tigress. So this is a tigress that was in captivity. And they found that she initially started eating sand, because she was given rotten meat to eat by accident. And so she had digestive issues. So she was eating this sand to kind of like alleviate her stomach problems. But then what happened was, is that over time, it became almost this obsessive compulsive thing for her to deal with anxiety. And we know that animals that are in captivity often deal with like obsessive compulsiveness because, you know, they're in confined areas. It's a stressful environment. So for that animal, she was actually using the, you know, actually eating sand to deal with her own anxiety. And that's often what we see in humans with pica.
That's incredible. Like, that is just amazing that, I don't know, maybe this is really rude of me to animals, but I always just think, like, how do you have the concept of, you know, emotions like anxiety? And so maybe it's not, I don't think how, but I think, do you have that? You know, like my cats, when I leave them in the house all day and then I come home and they're super excited to see me. And it's like, I don't know, it's just so interesting because they don't speak. So you don't know what's going on. But the fact that they actually, I mean, do they like experience things like depression, anxiety, that sort of thing? Can animals experience that?
Yes, it's actually been shown that, and there are some studies done on this, rats in particular, if you put a rat in a distressing situation, so maybe like you put a rat behind a wall, it'll start to cry and the other rats will try to free it. Or like there have been monkey studies where monkeys will save, you know, food for another monkey, or, you know, they'll share with other monkeys. But rats are particularly empathetic, you know, they'll help other rats, you know, they'll take care of other rats. So animals can experience emotions. And we do have ways to measure things like anxiety and depression using like different, I guess, models. But we really have to go off of behavior because the animals can't speak. So for example, if we want to look at anxiety in an animal, basically what we're measuring is the animal's avoidance of a novel situation. So we know that animals like mice or rodents are really curious. So the idea is that if you put a rat in a novel situation, so like a new, you know, a new experience, you put the rat through a new experience, like if you put the rat in a like a new box or something, an anxious rat will explore less than a less anxious rat.
Wow. That is actually amazing. I think it's so clever as well. I mean, it's so easy, isn't it, when you hear about the kind of way that you're testing these things in animals and you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Like, it's a new situation, that's could be anxiety provoking, but actually the work that must have like happened behind that to think about, you know, how could we actually test anxiety or binge eating or anorexia in these models is just, yeah, it's just a whole host of things going on behind the scenes as well as actually what happens. So that's really cool. I do really want to talk to you about your PhD as well. So, I mean, the title very nicely explains the effects of anorexia symptoms in adolescents on anxiety in adulthood after weight gain. So could you kind of give us an overview of like what you're looking at, where that inspiration came from?
Well, a lot of it was just kind of from my own experiences because I have an anxiety disorder, specifically, well, generalized anxiety, but social anxiety. So if I seem anxious, that's why. but so that's part of why, you know, from my own experiences, just my own experiences with anxiety and anxiety and anorexia. But there also haven't been a lot of studies looking at anxiety in people who have quotations recovered from, you know, anorexia. And obviously we know recovery is different for everyone and we all define it a little differently. And typically in research, people define recovery as weight restored. And the other part of the inspiration for my PhD came from a study that my lab did. So what they found was that if you put adolescent female rats, through the model of anorexia that we use, those rats will be more anxious when they're adults and their weight restored than rats that didn't experience those anorexia symptoms. So their anxiety actually increases.
Is that because of changes in the brain or?
Yes. So they found that it was changes in stress response. So parts of the brain that deal with how you respond to stress. And I found that in an area involved in anxiety, there was prolonged inflammation in that brain area, even though the animals were weight restored.
Wow. And I mean, I think it's really interesting because, like, a lot of the time, I think when people speak about eating disorders and comorbidities and stuff, they talk about anxiety, and a lot of the time it's, you know, specifically in anorexia, sort of that low weight, which causes those mm-hmm. symptoms. But actually the fact that, you know, it once your weight restored and considered recovered, that's really interesting. I'm actually, sorry, my brain is like flying around with questions now. But I was just, I mean, and this is more just a point I'm going to make rather than a question, but you might know. So I had atypical anorexia. I lost about a third of my body weight, but I still remained at a quote-unquote healthy BMI.
Likewise.
Yeah. So, so I was just thinking then, like, I also have anxiety, and I'm considered weight restored. So do you think it was because, right, let me try and get my words out because it's all flying around the room, getting so excited. Take a deep breath. So do you think, because of that weight loss to a place where my body wasn't comfortable, and at the end of the day I was in a starved state, is that still gonna have the same sort of pattern in terms of now being weight restored? Or do you think that would have to be a different study because it wasn't sort of the BMI of under 18.5?
So are you asking that would you have the same anxiety as when you were, classified as being sick as you would when you were classified as being recovered?
I think this might be what you've just said, but I think what I'm trying to ask is, so your study is looking at the sort of like people that had anorexia, so a low weight, and now, this is what I'm assuming, by the way, please tell me if I'm wrong, and now they're in a recovered, weight restored state. Yes. And you're looking at the anxiety. So do you think that the same sort of progression to the anxiety would have happened for somebody with anorexia nervosa as atypical anorexia, despite the fact that they weren't classified actually as underweight but had lost weight?
I think so, because and this is just my own thinking, is that I think one, eating disorders are so complicated and, you know, they're complex, and that just because, I mean, we do know that malnutrition and being underweight has, influences the brain in certain ways. We've seen that people with eating disorders, their brains are actually smaller in size when they're malnourished. And then when they are weight restored, their brains increase in size. So there are differences, obviously, in the being underweight. However, I also think that, you know, everybody's an individual, and that we'd have to look at each case, you know, on a case-by-case basis. So I don't know. I feel like with so much emphasis on weight restoration, and even though that's what my dissertation is looking at, it's more of like a research, you know, aspect. But I do think we would probably see the same thing in people with atypical anorexia.
Yeah. It's interesting what you just said about the brain size. I don't know whether this is the reason why, but this is what my brain flipped to. So I am currently working in neuroscience as well, which is cool, but not in eating disorders. But I was speaking to my supervisor about my interest in eating disorders, and he said that he had tried to do a study looking at the brain, but it actually taught him a massive learning curve, in that participants with eating disorders are they're not hydrated. So actually being able to look at their brain, you can't do like an MRI scan because they're not hydrated.
Yes. That definitely makes sense, because with MRIs, one of the things that we're looking at is, it's been a while since I learned about MRIs, but I'm pretty sure it has something to do with like water and oxygen. That would make sense.
Okay. So that's really interesting, that the kind of the same patterns. I mean, obviously the research would need to happen, but, So is there sort of a particular part in the brain that is responsible for kind of the anxiety symptoms that's affected in anorexia?
That's actually one of the things that I'm looking at. So the previous study that I mentioned that my lab did looked at an area called the amygdala. And usually when people talk about like feelings and anxiety, they think about the amygdala. But there's research that shows that the amygdala might actually be more involved in fear and not anxiety. So we know that the difference between fear and anxiety is that fear is when it's something that's known. So like you're scared of a specific thing. Anxiety is more like an uncertain, ambiguous thing. So there's a distinct difference between fear and anxiety. And so an area of the brain that might be more involved in anxiety is called the BNST. And that's the area that I'm looking at. And what's cool about the BNST is that basically it's kind of like a judgment center. So your brain has all these different areas that kind of take information from, you know, your thoughts and also from like external things. So like sensory information, how you're feeling. And so all these different brain areas send this information to the BNST. And then it's the BNST's job to kind of come up with a verdict of whether you should be anxious about what you're experiencing or whether you should, you know, not be anxious about what you're experiencing. And then it makes its verdict and then it sends this information to other areas of the body or to the brain. And then those areas of the brain send information like signals to the rest of your body, and then you respond to that. So if your BNST decides, oh, you know, this type of information is something you should be anxious about, then that's why your body then starts, you know, responding to it in a way that we interpret as anxiety.
Wow. You just reminded me why I love biology so much, because as you were saying that, I was like taken back to my neuroscience lectures at uni and like all the pathways on the board and just being like, that's happening inside me, this is insane. Thank you for re-sparking that excitement. What was I going to ask before I got super excited? So is your kind of theory that through anorexia, maybe malnutrition or particular behaviors, that BNST area is affected? Or
my theory is that there's an increase in certain cells in that area that are involved in kind of strengthening connections to brain regions that are involved in anxiety. So basically there's this increase in these connections that make us anxious about things. So, experiencing the symptoms of anorexia would then lead to, stronger connections in the brain that tell us that something is anxious.
Right. And so do those connections sort of grow stronger the more kind of certain behaviors, we participate in certain behaviors, I guess?
Yes. So that's basically how your stress response works. So, the more that we participate in something, avoidant behaviors or how we deal with stress or anxiety, our brain starts to learn, this is how this has worked before. You know, this is how we've dealt with stress or anxiety before. And then these connections get really strong. And then the problem is that when we're anxious or we're stressed, we fall back into those behaviors, those coping mechanisms. And, we can change how our brain is structured, how it's connected together, but that takes a really long time and a lot of diligence. That's one of the reasons why changing our behavior is so difficult, is because our brain is so, those connections are so strong if we repeatedly do those behaviors.
It's really, really interesting, kind of, I guess, looking at it rather from a way of just like talking about an eating disorder, like actually understanding what's going on in your brain. Mm-hmm. But I guess my question was, I get the science between, you know, that like neuronal synapse, and the more that you engage, the stronger it gets and stuff. But mm-hmm. and maybe this is just my like my perception of it, so it might have been biased, but it almost felt kind of when my eating disorder developed, again anecdotally, as soon as I engaged in that behavior, it was almost like there and that was it. Well, I guess I can't really remember that, but definitely sort of if I've had a relapse, it's felt like I've been doing really well and, you know, developing stronger coping mechanisms, and then all of a sudden I count calories one day and then I'm like, ah, everything's falling apart. So is that sort of, does that sound plausible, or is that just kind of me?
Yeah, that sounds definitely plausible. And just a way that, you know, people have, it's been shown that people use eating disorder behaviors to deal with like stress and anxiety. And there's actually a biological reason for that. So one of the more interesting ones that I know of is there's a hormone that you have in your body called ghrelin. And basically, well, it has a bunch of different things that it does. But one of the things that it's most known for is that it tells you when you're hungry. And so the less you eat, the more ghrelin your body produces. And for some people, ghrelin also is rewarding and it reduces anxiety. So for some people, wow. when they're not eating, their body's producing more of this ghrelin and they're actually feeling like a sense of reward and it's reducing their anxiety. So they've learned that if I don't eat, then, you know, this reduces my anxiety. And it's really hard to, you know, unlearn that.
Wow. Yeah. That's insane. What,
yes.
I mean, what kind of biological advantage does that have? Like,
I don't know. There are many things we don't know.
Yeah, no, that just sounds like a very silly advantage that needs to be dissolved in evolution. I guess, I mean, the question would be, because I don't want somebody to hear this and think, oh, well, that's why I don't eat is because I have this hormone that means that I feel good when I don't eat. So how do you sort of combat that? Is it about having different coping mechanisms, or?
Yeah, I would think with anything, it would just be developing different coping mechanisms. We don't know enough to know if, I mean, I'm assuming that the brain would change if you stop engaging in certain behaviors, because that's what the brain does. The brain is what we call plastic, so it can change. And if you stop engaging in certain behaviors, then your brain will change. So my thinking would be, and this would be something that would need to be tested, but if you stop engaging in, you know, so much, I guess, self-starvation or food restriction, then maybe your brain would change the way that it responds to those chemicals.
Mm. Yeah. I also wanted to ask you about, I mean, and this is in your PhD, so you may not know the answers yet, but I don't know whether you have some particular ideas about the types of anxiety that people recovered from anorexia, my experience.
Yes. So I got this idea because, so I work with two different advisors, and one of my advisors works with animals and the other one works with humans. And so I was telling my human, the person who works with me with the human side of things, and he said, oh, you're looking at anxiety. What type of anxiety? Like, what type of anxiety are you looking at in the rodents? And I was like, type of anxiety? Because with rodent studies, it's just the rodent is avoidant of certain situations. That's anxiety. You're not really thinking about what type of anxiety is that. Mm-hmm. So it got me thinking, oh, well, what types of anxiety do people with anorexia experience? And I started looking it up, and there has actually not been a lot of studies looking at anxiety type in people with anorexia,
wow.
Particularly people who have been recovered from anorexia. So we know that OCD is the most common. Social anxiety is very high too. A lot of people with anorexia have social anxiety, but then apart from that, there really hasn't been that much research. And so one of the things that I'm interested in is that people who have experienced anorexia symptoms or anorexia-like symptoms. So for my dissertation, I'm not going to be using people who, were diagnosed with anorexia. Rather, they're people who were, I guess you would classify it as atypical, maybe anorexia, or people who experience anorexia-like symptoms. But do people who experience anorexia symptoms, when their weight restored, you know, when they've quotations recovered, what types of anxiety are they experiencing? You know, are they still experiencing obsessive compulsiveness? Are they anxious about their food? Are they anxious about exercise? Are they anxious about, you know, the way their body looks? Are they anxious about social situations? So, you know, even though they're recovered, are they still experiencing, you know, anxiety that's related to their eating disorder?
I absolutely love that idea, because I yeah. think we're still so stuck in a world where weight restoration is yes. the most important and pivotal thing. And yes, obviously, mm-hmm. weight restoration is important. But as you've just mm-hmm. listed off there, anxiety around exercise, food, body image, social situations, all of that, I think mm-hmm. are such core parts to an eating disorder
yes.
that are often not target. I mean, I had treatment like 14 years ago, so maybe mine was a bit different, but it still doesn't feel like they're kind of things that are specifically looked at.
Yes.
So yeah, I mean, that sounds amazing. If that, I mean, obviously it's going to be different for everybody, but I guess then the next thing would be like to think about, you know, supporting in treatment and stuff like that. So it's really great that you're looking into that.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that I found a study because I was interested in seeing what studies have been done in anorexia or with anxiety in recovery from anorexia. And there was a recent study where they took people who had been hospitalized for anorexia and they interviewed them. And then 6 to 12 years after they'd been released from the hospital, they interviewed them again. And what was interesting is that 85% of those people no longer had symptoms of anorexia, but 80% of them had either an anxiety disorder or they were depressed. And only half of those people had those disorders prior to their anorexia. So that means that either during their illness or during their recovery, they somehow developed either an anxiety disorder or a depression.
Wow. That's mind-blowing.
Yeah. Yeah, because mostly you hear about like anxiety leading to eating disorder development, which mm-hmm. is true. But that study shows that the anorexia itself might lead to other disorders.
Yeah. And it's almost it's almost as though it could potentially be that the anxiety came and the anorexia was a way of relieving those symptoms, but there wasn't maybe a massive recognition of the anxiety beforehand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it kind of exacerbated it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, again, I've said anecdotally about 50,000 times, but when I look back on my childhood, I was that what people called annoying child, because I couldn't stay away from my home on a sleepover. I had to be with my parents, and I had a lot of anxiety around social situations. And like at the time, my parents would always joke like, oh, Hannah, you're such a worrier. But actually now I'm like, no, that was anxiety. And then the eating disorder came and, like you say, it exasperated it. So yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm really interested to see what you find, because that'll be really interesting to know.
Yeah.
I have a couple of questions from the listeners for you.
Okay.
So where have they gone? I suppose we've kind of covered. So one of the questions, was which regions of the brain are most affected and what are the implications? So I suppose we spoke about anxiety, but we didn't speak about the areas for eating disorders, I guess.
Okay. So this is really, it's kind of contradicting what we people do who study neuroscience do, but there's a misconception that one brain region is involved in like one thing, like the amygdala is involved in emotions, or the hypothalamus is involved in eating motivation, or there's an area called the VTA that's involved in reward. And those areas are really involved in, specific interpreting like specific information. But at the same time, your brain is, you know, connected. So one thing or one brain region is going to feed into another brain region, into another brain region. So it's really hard to say if there's a specific region that's involved in eating disorders, because the brain's just, you know, connected in so many different ways. But some of the primary ones are the hypothalamus. So that's involved in like food intake. I would say the VTA. So that's involved in things like reward and motivation. Probably like the amygdala, the BNST, that's involved in like emotions. And probably your prefrontal cortex, because that's involved in like thinking and, you know, kind of making decisions. So basically pretty much the whole brain.
That's just eating disorders though, isn't it? Like, I had a conversation with somebody the other day and they were like, what causes an eating disorder? And they wanted one thing. And I was like, oh, well, I'm afraid we've got a journey to go on, because it's not just one. Yeah. But I think that makes sense. You know, the whole brain is working. It's working together through the neural networks and stuff. So it makes sense that there's not kind of a specific area. And also, if there was a specific area that was like, I'm the eating disorder area,
yeah, exactly,
then hopefully we would have something to target that area and turn that area off. that would be the dream. And then the other question was, how long does it take to heal the brain, and what therapy has shown to be have the most positive impact?
Okay, so we're still learning about like recovery from eating disorders. Eating disorder that people have looked at the most is anorexia. And, you know, I don't really think there's a reason for that with human studies, because we know that binge eating disorder is the most common, but people still tend to focus on anorexia. But what's been shown is that we do see brain changes during illness, and sometimes we see brain changes, you know, post-illness. But we often see like a restoration in size. So we're still kind of not really sure exactly how the brain heals. We know that the brain can heal, but we're not quite sure how long it takes, or if some parts of the brain heal and other parts, you know, don't heal as well, or things like that. But as for treatment, we know that CBT has been shown to really increase like neural connections. So create those new neural connections that you need to be able to change your behavior. So there's neuroscience evidence that shows that CBT does work in creating changes in your brain that help you during recovery.
Yeah, when I read the question, I thought CBT would be a good one, because that is constantly getting a behavior and going against it, doing it again and again and again.
Yes.
So much fun. That was brilliant. Thank you so much, Minda. I hope you can tell from how excited I was getting at all my questions how much I enjoyed that. So yeah, it was brilliant. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.